Well, tell me about dictionaries and why there's a necessity to have new ones, because this is a project that you've been involved in for quite a few years. Why do we need to constantly update the dictionaries?
Well, because our language is constantly growing and changing, and our life is constantly changing, so that it's been 20 years since there's been a new unabridged dictionary. So in those 20 years, we have a tremendous quantity of new ideas, which are all represented with words and new objects, new politics, new places and people that people, readers, want to find out about. So that's why we have 50,000 new words in this new book.
50,000 words?
Right, 50,000.
Now, the last edition came when?
21 years ago, 1966.
And there have been 50,000 new words?
Yes, that we've added. And 75,000 new definitions, to old words.
You mean the English language has actually created 50,000 words in the last 20 years?
Very much so. They come from every subject, every category you can think of. We've had, for example, we've added over 1,000 words having to do with computers alone. And most of them are not horribly technical at all. They're words that most of us have seen or heard. We've added over 800 new words about cooking and cuisine, brand new words, new dishes, the new fruits and vegetables that we see in the markets now, all the new cuisines.
So, in 1966, the word mouse had a different meaning.
Right. We didn't have the computer word for mouse, and we didn't have moose. We had for cooking, but we didn't have moose for hairspray. What it amounted to is 20 years ago, man hadn't walked on the moon yet. We hadn't had the first Super Bowl. We didn't have microwaves. Very few people had ever seen a computer. No one had ever seen or probably heard of a triathlon, of turf skiing, of ice dancing, which is now an Olympic competition. It just goes on and on.
Now, when did you begin your involvement with the this new unabridged edition?
Well, we began full-time. We have a staff of 30 at Random House Dictionary staff, and we've been working full-time on it for 9 years. Of course, we've started collecting sites as soon as the original unabridged was finished 21 years ago. So we've had, really, it's 270 person hours years to produce this, 9 years by 30 people.
So you had your, almost like your own division within Random House, huh?
Oh, very much so. We have a better part of an entire floor there in the office building. And in addition to the 30 people that we have, full-time editors, definers, we have over 400 consultants in these special fields in computers and astronomy, chemistry, poetry critics, people involved in the arts and so forth. And every time we write a new definition, when we're satisfied with it, we send it out to these specialized consultants just to be sure that those people who are very deeply involved in the field, the experts, agree with our definition. If they have anything they think we ought to add or change, that kind of thing.
Did the experts, was there a unanimity among the experts about the definitions of certain words, or did they too perhaps disagree?
Sometimes, not too often, but sometimes they'll disagree and we'll work it out. We'll go back and forth between the experts and our editors. Sometimes it'll go on for literally for years. Before we have a definition that we know that everybody will be pleased with. Certain things, laughingly, I keep saying, we can't do the definition until they decide themselves what this is going to be. For example, during the course of the book on the MX missile was being developed, and I think one of our early definitions was it was going to be on the railroad flat cars taken around, if you remember, I think during the Carter administration. And then after that, in the Reagan administration, the early years, was going to be the dense pack, if you remember that. They were going to put them all together in one place. So we kept changing that definition as the MX missile changed. And we finally got the definition when they began to build it. And, of course, then they changed the name to Peacekeeper. So we had to change the main entry, although, of course, we have the MX as a cross-reference. And that continues to happen.
Well, you've added some 50,000 words, but did you take some words out?
Very, very few. That's one of the problems, is that the unabridged dictionary just keeps growing. The older words, obviously, from the past that you find in the classics, in Shakespeare and Chaucer and so forth, you can't take out. And a lot of the words that may be dated now, we want to keep in, because this is a dictionary of record. And there are going to be students doing term papers, or reporters writing articles about the past, and they'll be reading the books and the clippings and come across these words that may be no longer in wide use, but they're going to wonder what they mean. So as a dictionary of record, we feel we have to keep almost all the old words. Now, the only thing we can really take out are, we have a great many biographical entries, people, because we're somewhat of an encyclopedia dictionary. And those politicians who did not make a lasting mark on history, we sometimes take out. For example, I'd leave in some of our earlier editions, we had in people who were running for president, or we thought would be candidates, and they weren't, did not become presidential candidates, and if they were senators or congressmen or something, did not make that lasting impression, so we might take that out. I think the example of that is the when Goldwater ran for president, we're going to put Miller in, who was his vice presidential running with him. And, of course, Goldwater lost, and Miller, very few people would look up now.
Well, they would be interested in Miller if they were interested in the American Express card.
That's true. But very few entries can we ever take out. It just keeps growing.
Well, how do you reconcile the differences in definitions, the English definitions, for example, as opposed to American definitions? Do you put them both in?
We put them both in if they're common. We do cover the complete English language, including Britishisms, Canadianisms, Australianisms, and so forth, mainly for the American reader, obviously, so that if you're reading a British book, novel, or you're a tourist or a businessman going to England and you will hear or see these terms, you'll know what they mean. So we have several thousand of the British terms in. Of course, we also have the variant British spellings, so that someone finds them in a British novel or is reading a London newspaper or something, that they'll realize it's not a typo, but that's the way the British do spell it.
But when you enter the definitions and the spellings for these words, do you do it in preferred order?
Well, we would label the British as British. As far as the other spellings, when there's variant spellings or variant pronunciations, we do it in the order in which they're most frequently encountered by good writers and speakers and editors.
Well, how did you determine that? Did you use a computer?
Yes, we have computers, and we also have, our experts, so that, and we have our citation files as far as the spellings go, so that we know that if we have the vast majority of spellings are one way, say a word is with or without a hyphen or capitalized or not, we would give that as the first. For example, spelling does change. Very few people realize that. Naive and naivete, for example, the diarces, the two dots we used to use, have almost disappeared. So now we are giving that as the most common use without the diarces, although we show that as a variant. Bypass in bypass surgery and so forth, when a word first became common, was almost always hyphenated. Now our citation files show that the major newspapers, magazines, medical journals, and so forth, no longer hyphenate it. They make it one word. So we give the bypass as one word as our preferred, our first form, even though we'll show the hyphenated form as a variant if people still want to use it.
This is a very large dictionary and a rather expensive one. To which audience is this dictionary aimed?
It's actually aimed at everyone, and I realize that you can't be everything to everyone. But this is the only up-to-date, complete record of the English language, and therefore we want it to be useful to, say, the average reader, the average person who's interested in words, and of course to the student, but also to the businessman, the scientist, the editor, and the writer who have to have a dictionary of record to be sure that they're spelling things right or pronouncing them right. If they're a speaker, they have the right definition.
I haven't seen the dictionary, but I assume it's rather large. It would be difficult for a college student to trundle it off the dormitory, wouldn't it?
Well, you'd have to keep it on a desk or somewhere else. You can't really easily carry it around. It's not a paperback. No, it weighs 13.5 pounds. It's over 2,500 pages. So it's the kind of thing that you put on your desk or stand, a coffee table, or keep on a bookshelf.
What about your background? How did you get involved in a project like this?
Well, I've been involved with Random House Dictionary since 1964, really.
So you worked on the last edition as well?
Yes, I was a senior editor on the last edition, and I was managing editor since then on our smaller college dictionaries and our paperback and school dictionaries. We have a whole line of dictionaries.
And what prepares you for a role like this?
Well, in my own case, I'm fairly typical. Well, the 30 people on staff, about half of them have degrees in linguistics or some other language-related studies. Most of them have graduate degrees. The other half of our staff have specialized and have their degrees in the topics that we have to have complete knowledge of. For example, there are people on staff who are used to writing definitions for us, who specialize in the physical sciences or the life sciences. The editor, for example, who writes and edits all of our drama, radio, and TV definitions, has an MA from the Yale Drama School, so that we have a fairly varied background amongst the staff. My own background is I started out in college to be a poet, and thought I'd better learn more words and more about language, so I began taking a few classes in the history of the language and in linguistics, and got hooked on words.
Well, I can't think of a better subject than poetry to study if one wants to use words.
I think particularly now, when people see new words, they're so apt to be in business. They're going to read today's newspaper or something like that and see new business terms or new terms in the sciences, and there's certainly a great many of them. But at the same time, the basic words and some of the older words in literature and having to do with poetry and the arts are every bit as interesting.
Do you still write poetry?
In these last 9 years, I have to admit I've been too busy on this dictionary.
What about the tedium involved in putting something like this together? It looks as though it would take intensive work and a lot of typing.
It takes intensive work. There's really no tedium because Dr. Johnson's old idea that a lexicographer is a harmless drudge really isn't true, because language is very exciting, and it leads you to the world, it leads you to people, because all these words represent things that people think or feel. These are words that people laugh over and cry over or get annoyed over, whatever. And I think, in my mind, language is communications. It's how you get to people and to their minds and hearts. And that's very exciting, because you are dealing very much with words and language, but in the background there, I think you never forget for very long that you're dealing with people and human beings and what they're saying and thinking and feeling. So I find it very exciting.
I have a computer at home, and I use a spell checker to back
right.
myself up. How do you back up your own spelling? I mean, are there any typos or misspellings in this huge dictionary?
Well, there's over 6 million words in it.
That you would admit to?
I don't know of any. Of course, it's a brand new book, and over the years, I'm sure we'll get a few letters from readers who have found a typo or something, and we would welcome them if they find any, obviously. But there's over 6 million words in the book, and if you cut the columns apart and end to end, they would make over a mile's worth of dictionary. You're buying a mile of dictionary. And everything has been through six levels, six stages of editing and six stages of proofreading, six stages of copy editing during these 9 years. So there should be very few typos of any kind. However, I know a book this big, having been in publishing for so long, there's no book published without a few little typos, and we're going to have
to edit that. You can't just sit down there and read it, can you?
Well, we have people who are used to copy editing dictionaries, and they read, one reads to the other. It's the old-fashioned double-eyed proofreading and copy editing. Actually, a dictionary is one of the hardest things to copy edit or to proofread that exists, because you show the pronunciation of each word, so you have the pronunciation system, the stress marks and so forth that have to be right. And then, of course, every word we give the history of. By the way, a new feature of this dictionary is we also show, in the etymology or the history of the word, we show the date when the word entered the language, first entered the English language, and that's a new feature for Unabridged American Dictionary. But the proofreaders and copy editors, in the word histories, we, of course, sometimes say this word comes from the Latin such and such, or from the Greek or the German or the Japanese word. So there are a lot of foreign words in those etymologies. Greek letters and everything else, and that gets very hard to proofread. And of course, in our definitions of chemical compounds, we also show the chemical formulas, so they get hard to read. So it's a very difficult job.
Well, they get lots of sleep, and they fall asleep at their desk trying to copy these.
Well, I don't think so.
Stand over them with a whip.
No, it's just a. If you're interested, and I think people who are good proofreaders and copy editors are really concerned. Unfortunately, they have to be. And when they find a mistake in that first or second stage, and I say it's been through six stages, they're pleased. It's they want things to be right.
They get a reward for every mistake.
I think the final reward, I guess, was now that the book is out, and you can see the printed book, and you can say, oh, we've worked for 6 years, and we finally have what we wanted.
What happens now? This project has been worked on for, you say, 6 years. Do you have a big party to celebrate, and then everybody breaks up, disbands?
Oh, no. This is Random House has had a permanent dictionary staff since the end of World War II, really, since the early 40s. And what we do, we continue to, we read just about everything, newspapers, magazines, cross-country. The staff reads about 2 hours a day, each of them. And the specialists also read in special categories. We read textbooks, novels, and nonfiction. And then the 400 consultants, most of them read the journals in the specialized field, medicine, law, and so forth. And we just keep right on reading for new citations, new words. In other words, someday there will be another edition of this, another 15 or 20 years. And what we're actually doing now is this Random House Unabridged Dictionary, the new one. Out of that, in about 5 years, we'll have a college dictionary, a smaller desk-sized dictionary, mm-hmm. and maybe 7 or 8 years down the line, of course, we'll have a new paperback dictionary. So we use this as...
A couple of years ago, they had a new thesaurus that they came out. They sent me a copy of that. So really, were you involved in that?
Very much so. In fact, I was one of the major contributors to it.
No, it's a dynamite thesaurus I keep on my desk, and I use that all the time.
Ah, very good.
What... in your involvement with the linguistics and words and so forth, have you been able to analyze how our language has changed over the past, say, 100 years? If I went back, or we went back 100 years ago, would we have difficulty in communicating?
No, not at all. If you just went back 100 years, there might be a few words that in the 1880s were fad words or... you might not have heard, you might not be using it, you might say, oh, that's an old-fashioned word. You may have heard your grandmother use it or something, your grandfather. They would have trouble because you'd be using so many words that they wouldn't know. The language keeps growing. As I say, if you would suddenly go back 100 years and would say something about your computer or something, well, they might not even know what a computer was. Or you say, I used my microwave oven last night. They would never have heard of a microwave, much less a microwave oven. So you couldn't talk to them about all the things you may talk about every day or refer to every day, but you would know what they were talking about, except a few of these terms. You may say, oh, gee, that's so old-fashioned. It seems humorous to me.
How do you handle slang?
We put in all the slang that we feel people are going to encounter in reading or in listening. We treat it as we do any other field.
What about old slang, like the 21
Skidoo and the Bee's Knees and all those? We'll have those in, too, because if you read some of the books from the 1920s or 1880s or whenever, you will find that slang, and particularly the student will want to know what it means. We label, of course. We have a great deal of slang and formal words, uses in the book, but we label them all because, of course, we want the user to know that they are not formal and that not to use them in formal contexts.
I would assume that slang would be one of the more... easier areas that can be dropped over a period of time?
Well, there is some ephemeral slang, let's say the Valley Girl talk of a few summers ago, but we have that in, and whether we'll drop some of that 15 or 20 years from now, I don't know. It really depends, is there enough of it in some of the novels and so forth that were written during the period that people will be reading 20 years from now, but we have it in now.
Tell me a little bit about the competition among dictionaries. We hear a lot about Webster's, and I've gotten so confused when I hear the term Webster, because everybody seems to be using Webster there somewhere, and
right.
I have a feeling that's kind of a public domain word now.
Well, it is. Unfortunately, Webster's lost the exclusive use of that word so that anyone can put the word Webster's on dictionaries, and so some of the Webster's are not very good because they're not true Webster's, I would say. The thing is, in the unabridged dictionaries, our new book, which has just come out, is the only one that has been published in over 20 years, so that, in a sense, there's no competition. The Webster's Third, it was a very good book. I think it's 26 years old now. It was a very good book then, but it is outdated, and I think they would admit that. The only other competition is the 14-volume OED, which is a completely different type of Oxford English Dictionary, which is a... dictionary along historical principles. They give all the citations, or they give citations that they've collected over the years. And that's, of course, I say 14 volumes, and I think there's a four-volume supplement, and that runs somewhere around $1,500 to $2,000. The amazing thing is, in the entire English language, in Australia, Canada, England, United States, etc., there are only one single-volume unabridged dictionaries available, and ours is the only one that's not 20 years old.
Well, let's assume, just hypothetically, that Webster's Unabridged has been reissued, new publication, and it meets the Random House Unabridged head-on. How does a critic, a book critic, judge it? How does one, or even a reader, I mean, what basis do you determine which dictionary would be best for one?
I think if you were comparing dictionaries, I say you really can't do that now, and Webster's has said they won't come out with a new Unabridged for another 10 years, so in a sense there is no competition. But if you have two college dictionaries or two paperbacks, I think you would check a couple of words. Obviously, if you're interested in a particular field, if you are interested in slang, or you're interested in astronomy or biology or art or whatever, you might pick out a half a dozen or a dozen words and see if they're there, and be sure that a few of those terms are fairly recent ones to be sure it's an up-to-date dictionary. Then see, when you read those definitions, which are the fullest, which give you the more information about the term. You'd want to look at the pronunciations and see if it's an easy-to-use pronunciation system, and I hope ours is. If you're interested in usage, you want to read their usage notes. We have many hundreds of usage notes in the Unabridged, but of course you get down to a paperback, you get fewer and fewer. Are the usage notes there? Are they good ones? If you are interested at all in history and where the words came from, you'd read the etymologies. Do they give you the information you want? Is it readable and understandable?
Layout is important, too.
Very much so. I think with our new dictionary, I'm very pleased because the type is almost novel size. It's not that little bitty dictionary size.
Well, that's why it's so big.
Well, it's we have actually there's over 500 more pages than in the previous Unabridged dictionaries, which we need for all those 50,000 new words. But it's very readable, and we've used very good quality paper, which you have to because an Unabridged dictionary people are going to be using for the next 20 years, or it's a lifetime purchase. But I know
you're right about looking at dictionaries. There are a number of dictionaries, and some of them are, in my opinion, deficient. I can look at them, and they don't have enough words in them, or the definitions aren't extensive enough. And just comparing them side by side, you can really tell a difference.
Right. There are a few dictionaries that are really they're on the market. In fact, some are sold. They're not true Unabridged, but some are sold. We call them discount specials, and in the trade. But some of them are sold. And there's one out there for about 1995 that I see advertised all the time. That hasn't been updated since 1955. And you look at it, and it looks like something your grandfather should have had in his home, perhaps. And it doesn't have any term really since World War II in it. And that's unfortunate. It gives sets people off, but as I say, in a sense, it's almost a brand name thing. That's why we've kept, we call ours a Random House Dictionary of the English Language, and have not tried to use anyone else's name and so forth, because we hope people will know if it's a Random House that we do have this staff and we do try to do things right.
Also, Flexner, 2 weeks ago I broke down and gave to the Salvation Army my set of Funk and Wagnalls encyclopedias that I bought at the A&P in 1959 for a dollar each.
Ah.
And now, these weren't very good encyclopedias at the time, but they were really small, and I carried them around with me for years and years. They're pretty dog-eared, but they're okay if you're interested in things prior to 1945, before 1950.
Right.
It's all right. They're not very extensive, but I finally had to bite the bullet. So I no longer have a set of encyclopedias, and I don't think I have, in Manhattan, I don't know if people have room. Well, this is certainly an impressive project. How many words? 315,000?
Yes, in total there's 315,000 words, and literally tens of thousands of sample sentences showing how they're used in context, hundreds and hundreds of usage notes, 2,400 illustrations, spot maps, and of course in the back of the dictionary we have a complete four-color atlas, basic manual of style, which we hope is of use to the student and the writer and the businessman.
These, incidentally, the geographic, I assume you have geographic terms and
right.
Names, and and bibliographic names are very important for us here, because we have an old unabridged, you probably saw it out there, and I don't know where they got it, but we use it all the time because we need to pronounce things correctly, and sometimes we don't, and we no longer have a linguist on our staff. We used to have kind of a conscience who would listen, monitor night and day, and send us memos, and we don't have that anymore. It's a luxury CBS doesn't really have, but I know that the Random House Dictionary is going to help us continue to do things the right way. And my last question for you, Stuart Flexner, what are you going to work on now?
Well, as I say, we're working on the next edition for 15 or 20 years from now, and we're really going to work on the abridgment of this to make this into a college or desk dictionary, but that'll be about 5 years away. But that'll be a good 5 years of work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.